Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
6 minutes after the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, broadcasting live from the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mic 92.1. Tom is trying to broadcast from his undisclosed location on Monday live. Stay tuned for that, and we'll hold down the fort for the rest of the week. It is certainly a day to commemorate, certainly a day of introspection, and is certainly a day where time seems to stop, and the last 7 years get condensed together into this post-9/11 world we've been living in, but it all started 7 years ago today. And I will never, like anybody who's older than 7 years old, I won't forget where I was 7 years ago today. I was producing a local show here in Madison, Wisconsin, a morning show, and the host was talking about the local Humane Society, and it was rather... at the time, it seemed like the most important story of the morning until we got the first reports, and we had a TV monitor in the studio, and you could see smoke coming from World Trade Center. And our news guy got on the air and said, there's nothing to worry about. There was just a small Cessna that had hit the World Trade Center, and it was just an accident. But we kept monitoring the local or the TV news and continued to talk about the Humane Society. And it was... It was just like a crack of thunder when watching CNN and seeing what's next and seeing smoke rising from the first building, and you saw the live shot of the second building hit, and you knew something was afoot. And I stormed into the studio in the middle of the Humane Society segment, and I said, we've got to put this down right now because something big is happening in New York City. Little did we know then that it would dictate the next 7 years of all of our lives. It would dictate what would become of our civil liberties. It would mandate what would become of our foreign policy. It would pave the way for thousands of more casualties over the next 7 years. And the idea that what happened 7 years ago today took place in a vacuum and came from out of nowhere is ignorant at best. The idea that the chickens have come home to roost, in Jeremiah Wright's words, seem to strike a chord with me anyway, that the United States does not exist in a vacuum, that what we have done with our foreign policy was to put our priorities first and make everything else secondary. And when we armed the Taliban in Afghanistan to fight the Cold War on our behalf, Charlie Wilson's war, well... once that Cold War was over and we decided they don't need guns anymore, therefore they don't need our help anymore, we turned the other way and we ignored them. As they tore down their idols, as they ruined the history of Afghanistan, the history of civilization, and as they took over the country that we propped up with our weapons, and then September 11th, 2001, with still a big gaping hole in the middle of Manhattan. That is, according to CNN, taking too much time to redevelop and is taking... And here's the thing. As I was trying to find... it's Tom Hartman's show. He's the smartest voice on radio. He's got the smartest audience. So I'm like, September 11th, you got to come up with an expert for what happened on this fateful day. Well, you know what? There is none. There is no expert. You could go to Philip Zelikow, who authored the majority of the 9/11 Commission report, but I don't trust him. He was in constant contact with Karl Rove in the White House while drafting the 9/11 Commission report. May go to why there are so many Swiss cheese holes in the 9/11 Commission report. I could go to Popular Mechanics, but they've been debunked by the 9/11 Truth. I could go to 9/11 Truth, but they've been debunked by Popular Mechanics. So what happened on September 11th, 2001? Well, it paved the way for what we see today, an ongoing and endless occupation in a country that had nothing to do with September 11th, 2001, although the argument was made either they had something to do with it or they will attack us and they can. I don't have the experts, and I don't know what happened. I am left with questions and that hole in my soul that feels on the inside of me like Ground Zero looks on the outside.
The $16 billion rebuilding project is years behind schedule and billions over budget. The Port Authority isn't commenting about the delays. The victims' families are hoping that, at the very least, the memorial can open in time for the 10th anniversary. But critics say right now, that looks like a long shot.
Not bloody likely, and here we are 7 years down the road. So I'll turn it over to you, because I really don't know. And we will be joined in a couple of minutes by Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent. She served for 24 years. Was legal counsel to the FBI field office in Minneapolis and became an FBI whistleblower in the aftermath of September 11th. We know that in the 7 years since that we have not gone, taken to task the country from where the majority of these terrorists came from. We didn't take Saudi Arabia to task. In fact, we brought him over to the Crawford Ranch, held hands, and played kissy face. Even though our president's some big homophobe, it doesn't make any sense. Today, Barack Obama and John McCain have decided to put aside politics, evidently, and appear together for the annual ceremonies commemorating September 11, 2001. But I seem to remember Judith Miller reporting on the 4th of July, 2001. Remember Judith Miller from the New York Times, who had the direct portal into news and rumors and the outing of Valerie Plame that came directly from the vice president's office. Judith Miller expected the terrorist attack to take place July 4th, 2001. She says that Washington, D.C. was on edge. She also said she didn't write about it in the New York Times because she was busy writing another book. We know about the August 6th presidential daily briefing that went to the president that said bin Laden determined to attack inside the United States. We know now about the FBI letter after the capture of Zacharias Moussaoui about Al-Qaeda determined to learn how to fly planes, but not necessarily land them. A memo that went all the way up to George Tenet's office before September 11, 2001, but nobody knows quite what became of it. There is much conjecture surrounding World Trade Center Building 7 and how that came down. The official report was that somehow the heat made it expand and it blew up. I'm not sure I buy it. I don't know what happened on September 11th. I will buy Occam's razor, though, when you try to find an explanation for it, and it boils down to this for me. Due to grave incompetence, due to gross neglect, due to absolute inability to understand or process the information that was being given to the very top of our intelligence agencies and the president himself, we dropped the ball 7 years ago today. People saw it coming. Judith Miller saw it coming. She expected it the July 4th, 2001. The president was told it was coming August 6, 2001. The CIA director, George Tenet, was told about the airplanes and Zacharias Moussaoui in custody before September 11th. And yet it happened anyway. And the president continued to read My Pet Goat for another 7 minutes. And instead of taking to task the nation that we held, should have held accountable for their terrorists in Saudi Arabia, we went to war with Iraq. And instead of making sure we overthrew the Taliban, we just marginalized them for a time and had Osama bin Laden cornered in the mountains of Tora Bora until our Marines there were called off in Afghanistan so they could redeploy to fight the what has become the endless occupation of Iraq. Broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin, I find it fascinating that the national news media story the last couple of days has been, 8,000 troops coming home from Iraq, 8,000 troops coming home from Iraq. The largest deployment of Wisconsin National Guard troops since World War II is happening right now. And while the mainstream media's headlines are all 8,000 troops coming home from Iraq, failing to compare it to the 130-some, 140,000 troops that are there right now, and as many, if not more, private mercenaries and contractors, and failing to mention that the largest National Guard deployment from Wisconsin since World War II is happening right now, there's not a tapering off of this war. There's no withdrawal. There's no bringing the troops home. It's not happening. We do definitely live in a post-9/11 world. It is a scary world where the government gets secrecy and you have none. It is a terrifying planet where somehow the Bush administration gets to argue what happened September 11, 2001, happened in a vacuum and had nothing to do with our foreign policy the 20 years prior. And then we continue to hold hands with Saudi Arabia while they continue to hold fundraisers for martyrs and people that blow themselves up in Israel on their state-run TV. And what are we doing here 7 years later? Are we safer? ABC News investigative journalist Brian Ross can smuggle in nuclear material anytime he sees fit, and he does. We can't bring toothpaste on through airplanes, but people are still finding a way to get guns on. Where are we today? It's a nice time to take a step back, reassess, get away from the lipstick on a pig, and find out whether or not that's exactly what happened these past 7 years when it comes to our national security, our foreign policy, our civil liberties. All have been eschewed for the sake or the argument of national security, but are we safer? Sure, we haven't been attacked again since September 11th. London has, Spain has, we haven't. But then again, we haven't had aliens land either. So, I don't know what to say to you, other than we will have an FBI whistleblower join us who had direct knowledge of what Zacharias Moussaoui knew before September 11th. She has direct knowledge of the memo that was given to George Tenet, saying that Zacharias Moussaoui is an indicator that planes will be used by Al-Qaeda to attack the United States. August 6, 2001, Osama bin Laden determined to attack inside the U.S. July 4, 2001, Judith Miller expecting an attack, and you can expect that that information came from the VP's office. What happened? Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
After the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today, taking a look at what happened 7 years ago on this day, because we still don't know. It is impossible to fathom. One thing is for certain, there is one thing that has been left undone over the last 7 years that probably would have been on the top of the list of things to do starting, oh, say, September 12th, 2001. White House spokesperson Dana Perino yesterday.
That fight and that hunt will continue to go on until he is brought to justice. I will remind you that the top deputies have had a very tough time of it. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, is in jail today.
Yeah, the top deputies have been captured and tortured, or if you believe the Bush administration, have not been tortured, just used enhanced interrogation techniques. But if you buy that argument, I want to point out that you also have to buy the argument that John McCain wasn't tortured, but merely had enhanced interrogation techniques used against him. Yeah, Osama bin Laden still out there, huh? You'd find him at the gates of hell or something, but you could have had him in Tora Bora. So you would have, we were right there until we decided to redeploy our troops for Iraq. What happened 7 years ago? And what's happened since then? Everything we've held dear seems to have withered away, and we're left with what? A police state? A fascist state? A bought and sold media? Politicians who are playing this game of words and insults and innuendo while not talking about what they do for you and me? I wonder why that is. 866-303-2270. Let's go to Marcy in Santa Fe. Marcy, you're on Air America Radio.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I just want to give a little different take that I have on, you know, the scene where the president is reading My Pet Goat, and everybody's interpreted as that just shocked, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my thought, however, is that he was kind of, you know, he wasn't frozen in panic. I think he was doing bad acting.
Oh!
And I don't mean that he had planned everything, that he knew everything, but, you know, as you were saying, they obviously knew what was coming. They didn't know when it was coming, perhaps. But I think he was trying to pretend that he was afraid or he was worried. And that's, you know, look at that face, look at that look on his face, and I believe that's what it is.
7 years down the road, and he still hasn't learned how to act.
Exactly. Or read.
Thanks for the call, Marcy. Let's go to Jeff in Tacoma. Jeff, you're on Air America Radio.
Hey, Lee, just wanted to say that I was really appreciative of Rachel when she had you on her show all those many times.
Thank you, man.
Showed a lot of professionalism on her part to pick somebody nobody'd ever heard of. Who's
you're telling me.
Absolutely a great radio talent.
Thank you very much. What do you have to say on 9/11?
Well, you remember the CEO of Quest, in his defense, said that the Bush administration came to them in February of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And wanted to put one of those data splitters on their information and basically copy their entire internet, and that it would include phone calls and everything else.
Jeff, we also know that the oil fields in Iraq were divvied up in the first cabinet meeting of the Bush administration well before September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, and a lot of folks believe that oil task force or energy task force was all about that. But in terms of in terms of the data stream that would have been captured, and what probably was from AT&T and Verizon and the others, is that if they had put that much money and that much resources into studying that information, they would have known well in advance where the plots were coming from, who the people were that were communicating with foreign terrorists. And I believe that they would have known down to the minute who was where and what was taking place. And just want people to understand that if they had that kind of top-level knowledge, at minimum, they let it happen on purpose. And in many ways, the terrorists were facilitated. You know, they could have been picked up any time. They were caught on airport cameras. You know, they weren't listed on the manifest of the airplanes, but they got on the planes anyway.
Well, and some of them were known to the FBI. They were known.
Right.
And so every information, if you were to think, thanks for the call, Jeff. Here's what I'm going to take from what you had to say, that everything we've seen since September 11th, 2001 was, you could argue, put into play before September 11th, 2001. Now, if that is an argument that the government perpetrated or had some involvement in September 11th, I still can't find the facts. But maybe part of that has to do with the fact that the guy that wrote the 9/11 Commission report was taking tips from Karl Rove inside the White House at the time. Oh, well, then what am I supposed to believe? David in Florida, you're on Air America Radio.
Yeah, I just want to put a period on what you've been saying, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. But the irony of all of this is in congressional hearings where Condoleezza Rice was asked about the intel that they got, she said that they had information that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden were going to hijack planes and fly them into tall buildings. This is a month before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And she was asked, why wasn't anything done about it? Her comment, and this is unreal, they weren't specific enough as to what date. Is that ironic? And for this, she was given the congressional Medal of Freedom.
Yeah, and so was George Tenet, right? And
yeah, exactly.
He was another one that was given. Let me see here. I got it right here. He was given the memo by Colleen Rowley, who will be our next guest, a PowerPoint presentation, August 23rd, 2001. It was entitled, Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly. Well, that information isn't, it's not enough to figure out what they're going to do. August 6th, presidential daily briefing. Osama bin Laden determined to attack inside the United States. That's just not enough information. Judith Miller waiting on bated breath, July 4th, 2001, for the terrorist attack. That's just not enough information. Something tells me we could have done something differently. And something tells me that the gross negligence by the Bush administration is a fair argument to speculate that they may have been involved in it. However, I refuse to buy it. Not until I see proof. Colleen Rowley joins us next, and maybe that's exactly what she'll bring. She's an FBI whistleblower who knew about Zacharias Moussaoui well before September 11th, 2001. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman, Air America Radio.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Broadcasting from the Air America affiliate, the Mike 92.1 in Madison, Wisconsin. My guest this afternoon is Colleen Rowley. She was an FBI agent for almost 24 years. She was legal counsel to the FBI field office in Minneapolis from 1990 to 2003. She retired at the end of the end of 2004, and she has some unique knowledge about what was taking place inside her alphabet agencies in the lead up to September 11th, 2001. Thank you for joining me, Colleen.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, I just think you've got such an amazing story, and it goes all the way back to August of 2001 when the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in Minneapolis detained Zacharias Moussaoui. And why is it that Zacharias Moussaoui was originally detained, Colleen?
Well, there had been an investigation for a couple of days, actually, that revealed he had very suspicious ties to, extremists that might harm the United States. And in fact, he was connected. It turned out, of course, with a little further investigation, he connected right up to the Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was the mastermind of 9/11.
Oh, And flight school pilots ended up turning on the FBI to this guy, didn't they?
Absolutely. They were the first whistleblowers who even went against their hierarchy and called the FBI back on August 16th, a day or so before August 16th. And then Moussaoui was taken into INS custody on August 16th. So, you know, all this time leading up to 9/11, there were not only Moussaoui, it turns out, at least a couple of other very significant dots that were not connected. And, of course, my role in all of this, I had, we all, there were other, the agents were the investigators, but we all had this very unfortunate experience of almost seeming to be helpless before 9/11 and not furthering this investigation.
It blows my mind because August 23rd, just a week after the apprehension of Zacharias Moussaoui, a memo makes its way all the way to the top of our intelligence community. A PowerPoint presentation is given to our director of intelligence at the time, George Tenet, which is entitled, quote, "Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly."
Right. And, of course, you never heard George Tenet ever admit that in that whole time after 9/11. You actually heard quite the opposite. You heard a lot of, you know, cover-ups about what had happened, and nobody was willing to really unravel and examine the mistakes and these failures that had contributed to 9/11. You know, no one says that 9/11 could have been totally prevented. No one says that. But certainly there was a chance, if investigations had been pursued, that it could have been largely either minimized or reduced. It only took the Flight 93 20 minutes of warning to reduce the terrorist impact there. And, of course, it's bad enough to have seen 9/11 occur because of this type of mistakes. But then to see the mistakes that have occurred since 9/11, and a lot of it due just to the fact that there's been a strong reluctance on the part of the people in power to really reveal these types of mistakes that they made, and basically to examine what should we do, of course, to reduce terrorism without making the situation worse, without actually being more counterproductive to the United States security.
Colleen Rowley, our guest, an FBI special agent for almost 24 years, was legal counsel to the FBI field office in Minneapolis from 1990 to 2003. What was the feeling in the Minneapolis FBI field office after the planes hit on September 11th, 2001, Colleen?
Well, I think it's first a very sinking feeling that the worst suspicions had proven correct. I was actually in the Skyway here in Minneapolis walking from our office to the U.S. Attorney's office with the case agent. And we had in our hands, of course, the same draft affidavit that had lingered and been stalled for three and a half weeks. I mean, that was in our hands, and that became the basis then of a criminal affidavit to do the search finally. But when we were walking over, we actually thought to ourselves, you know, how much of this is going to be compartmentalized when the search finally does occur. But it was a sinking feeling, and, of course, the sinking feeling then quickly changed into, oh, my goodness, look what the bosses, I say bosses because it wasn't our immediate bosses, but it was the people in Washington that then circled the wagons right after 9/11 and refused then to really tell the truth to the American public and even to the victims of 9/11. So to a great extent, this is still going on.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why there remains such speculation and conjecture about what actually happened 7 years ago today. And in your opinion, Colleen Rowley, from the inside of the field office, does this more look like gross negligence and bureaucracy than some sort of government involvement in the coup?
Well, before 9/11, I do think it was it was negligence and even bordering a little bit on recklessness and whatever. But since 9/11, it's worse. Now you actually have deliberate people with deliberate knowledge of the truth and the facts have chosen to go. For instance, Iraq is a great example. I mean, you go into Iraq, and that's not negligence. That's deliberate malfeasance in some of the cases that have occurred. The 9/11 victims, for instance, the people in New York City right now who all have a higher level of asthma, and there have been many deaths among the rescue workers. And, of course, we hear, you know, this message today especially of honor and tribute and trying to remember 9/11, but none of it in a constructive vein.
Yeah.
It's all for this super patriotism. We got to win the war and engage in other countries in war. We're hearing that, and
yes.
Yet we aren't even helping the poor people who are the still many victims of 9/11.
Well, Colleen, for my money, your story only gets stranger after September 11th, 2001. And, for example, your letter dated May 21st, 2002 to FBI Director Robert Mueller, in which you say that the FBI's headquarters was unable to present facts so they could get a warrant through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act so they could search Zacharias Moussaoui's personal effects and laptop. Was this a failure of FISA, or was this a failure of the intelligence bureaucracy to get the information to FISA?
Yeah, this has been mischaracterized in order to allow for this now widespread monitoring. In fact, they've gone around the old FISA law. Bush administration immediately went around it. They did not even, I don't even know how long it was, but it wasn't very long before they did not even follow the law itself. So, and then they, of course, said, well, look, at the Moussaoui case, that's an example of why we can't follow this law. Absolutely not true. It was basically human error, through many levels down, but certainly in the FBI at a fairly low level, that they chose not to even go to the FISA court. It's hard to blame the FISA court when they've basically rubber-stamped almost every application that's ever been given to them.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, and then there's the afternoon of September 11th, 2001, when everybody's trying to figure out what's going on, when there's so much misinformation out there. But the one thing you do know is you have a terrorist in custody with ties to Al-Qaeda and Chechen rebels who was trying to learn how to fly a plane in the Minneapolis area. So during the afternoon of 2001, the acting U.S. attorney denies the FBI permission to interview with Zacharias Moussaoui. Why?
That's exactly right. And, of course, now, in this world of torture first, basically we're now being told we have to torture suspects, and of course many of them turn out to be totally innocent, which gives you nothing, but we're told that we have to torture the terrorist suspects in order to get information. When the truth is, even real solid terrorist suspects such as Moussaoui, we were not even allowed to interview, which means nicely ask the person, do they have any information that might help prevent another terrorist attack?
And you reminded FBI Director Robert Mueller of that in your May 21st, 2002 letter. What was his response to your letter reminding him that you wanted to interview Zacharias Moussaoui on the day of 9/11 but were prevented from doing so?
Well, you know, the letter led in part to the 9/11 commission, but this was a good question that never really got addressed. I tried to testify to the Judiciary Committee about it on June 7th, and one of the senators asked some questions, but it never really got brought up later. And in fact, at the same time, it wasn't, May of 2002, unbeknownst to me, basically the talk about the harsh interrogation tactics was already underway. And so, those types of things, I think July of 2002 actually was the time when they were authorized. It was long before anyone, of course, certainly at my level, knew anything about this.
Yeah.
And so this is why I think these things fell on deaf ears, is because they already had made up their minds.
Well, Colleen Rowley, who was the Assistant Attorney General at the time that in July of 2002 when Moussaoui wanted to speak and was interested in talking?
Well, it was Michael Chertoff, who's now the head of Homeland Security.
That's creepy.
Yeah, it is. He was actually kind of the overseer of the Moussaoui case for a while, and I even at some point I made a direct call into his office. I didn't get him personally, but I got another lady who was right under him, and I said, this is terrible. Here we have this one terrorist suspect in custody, and everyone says that we have to do all these things in order to stop the next round of terrorism, and yet we've made no attempt to even see what he knows about these things. That basically, and very few people, I have written about it a few times, but it just never seems to get traction in the sense that this is completely counter to the official explanations of why we have to engage in harsh interrogation
tactics. Why we have to go around the FISA courts, why we need to torture, why we need to invade Iraq. These are all based on a false premise.
Right. Here's this, in a very simple way, following the law, and certainly international law as well as our own domestic law, our own tried and true FBI and police investigative methods of determining guilt and innocence. And when 9/11 happened, those things just went up in smoke. The domestic law, international law, the tried and true methods of investigation, and they all went up in smoke under the rubric of the so-called war on terror.
I think it's more akin to what Dick Cheney referred to as the 1% doctrine, that if there's a 1% chance that something could happen, they should act as if it would. So what they ended up doing was acting as if anything could happen, anything that was in their best interest to act, that is. And on your way out the door from the FBI, Colleen Rowley, you wrote another letter to Robert Mueller in February of 2003, and here's what you said. I've got the quote here because I keep it with me wherever I go. If, as you have said, Robert Mueller, prevention of another terrorist attack remains the FBI's top priority, why is it that we have not attempted to interview Zacharias Moussaoui? In short, lack of follow-through with regard to Moussaoui and shoe bomber Reed gives a hollow ring to our top priority, so-called. This idea that we have to do all these things because of what happened on what happened to us September 11, 2001, it doesn't ring true from your perspective, does it, Colleen?
No, and you know, the worst thing here that many people think there's this trade-off between security and civil liberties and
right.
following the legal rules, etc. And it's the exact opposite. We would be doing such a much better job of reducing terrorism and making our country safer. Now, Michael Mullen, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, acknowledges that we're not winning the war in Afghanistan and terrorism is worse.
Here is the quote from Joint Chief of Staff Admiral Mullen yesterday.
You have all the makings of a complex, difficult struggle that will take time. I'm not convinced we're winning it in Afghanistan. I am convinced we can.
Colleen Rowley, can you stick around and take a couple of phone calls through the rest of the hour?
Sure.
Thank you so much. Colleen Rowley, our guest, an FBI special agent for almost 24 years, was legal counsel to the FBI field office in Minneapolis from 1990 to 2003. 866-303-2270. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Your calls with Colleen Rowley when we continue right here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's 52 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Today, my guest, Colleen Rowley, was the FBI field at the FBI field office in Minneapolis from 1990 to 2003. She knows firsthand about the capture of Zacharias Moussaoui and the knowledge that our intelligence agencies had prior to September 11th, 2001. She has agreed to stick around this afternoon and take your calls. And we start this afternoon with David in Missoula, Montana. Good afternoon, David. You're on Air America Radio with Colleen Rowley.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for doing this and talking about this. This is such an important issue. What I want to ask about is the Pakistani general from the ISI who wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta the day before, this is on September 10th, meeting with CENTCOM Commander General Tommy Franks, Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Wolfowitz Weiss, PNAC members, and Senator Graham and Goss, and then 9/11 happens. So let me repeat: he wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta and met with all these top officials. There's never been any investigation about this. This seems incredible. Can you comment on this?
What do you think, Colleen?
Well, I do know that the money. I don't know specifically about what David is talking about, the exact money transfer, but that part of it, which is the funding of, you know, certainly the 9/11 attacks and also the later, you know, the subsequent funding of al-Qaeda operations around the world is always going to be a crucial a part of the investigation, because this is actually who is behind it all. And
do you buy the 9/11 Commission report, Colleen?
Have I read it?
Do you buy it?
Do I buy it? Well, you know, the Chapter 8, which is the section on the dots that were not connected, whatever, actually, as far as it goes, is okay, up to a point. It is not comprehensive enough, and basically that what people don't understand is Chapter 8 was not an original thing that the 9/11 Commission investigated.
Really?
No, they relied solely on two prior things. They relied upon the IG, the Inspector General investigation that my memo gave rise to, and they also relied upon Eleanor Hill's joint intelligence. She was the staff, head of the staff for the joint intelligence inquiry before this. And actually, Eleanor Hill did a pretty darn good job.
so did Colleen Rowley, for that matter. Let's get to another call here. Abadu in Ohio, you're on Air America Radio with Colleen Rowley.
Yes, I have a question for Colin.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you said that Zakaria Moussaoui was arrested because the flight instructor called the FBI. I think that it's a false information.
Why?
Because I'm the man who want to stop September 11, and I was introduced to Zakaria Moussaoui, and I called the FBI, and I told them who introduced him to me, what they are looking for.
When was this, Abadu?
On August the 3rd, but my first call to the FBI was on July 2000. On August the 3rd, I called him, and I even said it's going to happen possible on 911 or 913. Zakaria Moussaoui was arrested because my information. It's not the instruction.
What happened
is conspiracy.
I appreciate the call. We're running out of time here, but Colleen, is it possible that somebody in our intelligence agencies was aware of Zacharias Moussaoui and his possible actions prior to August of 2001?
Well, I think it is not only possible with our own intelligence agencies, and certainly George Tenet was the director of Central Intelligence, and he was somewhat aware, but it's also possible with regard to other foreign intelligence agencies. And that's another aspect that's never been, it's still very murky, it's never been totally examined, and it's another reason why perhaps a 9/11 second commission that is a little more thorough is in order.
And isn't in direct contact with the political advisor of George W. Bush inside the White House. Colleen Rowley, I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I want to thank you because I don't know what we would know about September 11th, 2001 without you standing tall and standing up for the truth and being a whistleblower in the face of, I can't imagine what sort of consternation you caused inside our intelligence agencies. Thank you, Colleen, so much for joining us on this day and for standing up for what's right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleen Rowley, 866-303-2270. What do you think of that? I guess it goes to the heart of the more we know, the less we know. I don't even know what to say about it other than we still don't know. 866-303-2270. My name is Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My name is Lee Rayburn. I'm sitting in for Tom Hartman today, broadcasting from the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mike 92.1. Thank you for having me along for the ride. We spent the last hour talking about this day, this anniversary, this commemoration, and I have a number of people on the phones, and I know from doing this before that we could spend 3 hours of Tom Hartman's show talking about what you think happened September 11th, 2001. We heard from Colleen Rowley at the in the last hour. It was the FBI whistleblower that told the story about Zakaria Moussaoui, how he was captured before September 2001, how the information was sent all the way to the top of the CIA with George Tenet in August of 2001, and how even after September 11th, 2001, the uppity-ups and the higher-ups in our alphabet soup of intelligence refused to allow any interrogation of Zakaria Moussaoui. I guess they wanted to tenderize him first, huh? And we could take this all the way throughout the rest of the show, but there is more going on today, and I don't want to drag this into the pig on a lipstick comment, but there is a broader scope here that I think Tom touched on his show yesterday that I want to get back to. The truth about September 11th, 2001, I don't know. And for that matter, neither do you. We can continue to speculate, but more importantly, we should continue to pursue the truth. Until we get there, let's not claim that we know that it was an inside job, or claim that we know that it was whatever you think it was. How can we possibly know with the vacuum of information that has been created by this Bush administration? I want to take a moment to laugh at John McCain. Sorry. I want to take a moment to talk about how, as Andrew Sullivan has now pointed out, I think it was in The Atlantic, if you go by the definition of torture that President Bush has adopted and John McCain has endorsed, then John McCain was never tortured as a prisoner of war. He merely faced enhanced interrogation techniques by our country's own definition, which I'm not saying John McCain wasn't tortured. I'm saying our own country's definition of what torture is FUBAR. And the problem here is on this commemoration of September 11th, 2001, the media is doing this boo-hoo, but we're not talking about what's happened in the last 7 years in this so-called post-9/11 world. What has become of this country? What about our rights? What about our foreign policy? What about FISA? And it goes to the heart of what we're getting to in November, a possibility of change, and the fear that many have, and we'll talk about this in the next hour, that change won't come no matter how we vote because our votes won't be counted. But I want to get back to lipstick on a pig for a reason. Because this presidential election is a joke. It's a sham, and the problem is not the candidates. And I'm not blaming John McCain. He can try any silly tactic his heart desires. The problem is the media, me, us, the folks on the other end of your radio dial, at the other end of your TV tube or your flat screen high def, whatever. Because for my money, political commercials are the most important commercials there are. Sure, you can get commercials for fast food. You can get commercials for whatever you'll hear in just a couple of minutes. But the most important commercial of all is that one for who will be deciding what's best for you, your pocketbook, your rights, your freedoms, your family, your opportunity at education, your opportunity at Social Security, and any other social safety net? And the problem is that the political process we now work with the media, is corrupt at the very core of it. The fact that the majority of campaign cash raised by our politicians gets poured into the media, and then that limits the coverage of election in the media to trivial tabloid idolatry, which is exactly what we've seen with Sarah Palin, while allowing the debate about the issues to merely be confined to 30 seconds, those 30 precious seconds and priceless seconds we call a commercial, with full license, and we've seen it with the McCain campaign, full license to lie, distort, and accuse without any accountability, providing they pay for the time. And that creates what it is at the core, a political system that is corrupt. Candidates shouldn't be allowed to buy airtime ever in the media. It should be given away. After all, the airwaves, the TV, your telephone, your radio, they still belong to you. And the media is licensed and chartered by the government, which is us. You see the connection there? It's us. We can revoke the media's rights at any time, and the time has come. We don't need to revoke the media's rights, license, and charters if our media starts giving away what politicians now pay for with their soul, an opportunity to have the issues heard in the middle of a 30-second commercial while leaving all the tabloid foofara to what we now consider quote-unquote news. And this is, I want to say this to anybody who is considering running for office, and we all should, to every politician all the way up the ladder, all the way to Barack Obama, hey, stop putting up with it. Quit being blackmailed by the same media conglomerates that reject reporting your issues and leaving it up to your opponent's vapid 30-second spots. Go get a video camera if your cell phone doesn't already have one, and try a telecampaign with YouTube. It won't cost you a dime, or it'll cost you the price of a video camera, which at least will be less expensive than one TV commercial. Register a blog at blogspot.com and update it every day with your view on the issues and where you would take this country or your community in the future. That won't cost you a single dime. Get a sandwich board or a big sign and hold court at busy intersections during rush hours explaining your refusal to sell your soul, and that's only going to cost you your time. The truth is, and we're seeing it played out in this campaign every day, The revolution will not be televised. The revolution is your television. So as long as money is equated to free speech and corporations are viewed as people by our Supreme Court, as long as the media demands that free speech, in order for any voter to hear a candidate's side on the issue, will remain the definition, this will remain the definition of insane. Period. We will continue to do the same thing over and over again every campaign and expect different results. We will continue to allow our media to create this tabloid vicious cycle of Sarah Palin's baby and Sarah Palin's baby's baby and Barack Obama said pig and lipstick in the same sentence. Instead of talking about here, this is what we should be talking about. What about taxes and health care for the two presidential candidates? What about the fact that Barack Obama would cut your taxes unless you are a corporation that is currently not paying any income taxes or you are the richest 1% in this country? What about the fact that John McCain's health care solution actually includes a tax increase that nobody's talking about in the media? For the first time in the history of this country, we have a presidential candidate who would tax our employer-based health care. It would put a chilling effect on employers who are trying to provide health care for their employees because it would make it much more expensive. And for the first time ever, we would see our health benefits included in our income, and that would be taxable under John McCain's plan. But we're not hearing that, are we? What about Social Security and education? The social safety nets for the least, the oldest and the youngest? Well, John McCain wants to privatize those, create the veritable Walmart Social Security plan and veritable Walmartification of our education system, while Barack Obama wants to make sure it's available for all. What about the issues of Iraq and Afghanistan? I can't help but notice, but since the so-called surge, Bush, the president, has done almost exactly what Barack, the candidate, has said we should do, including diplomacy with Iran and North Korea, including a troop surge in Afghanistan, including adhering to a timeline to bring troops home from Iraq. Or at least that's what we told the Iraqi government until we told the American people something completely different. What about the issues? What about the fact that there is one presidential ticket out there that would overturn Roe v. Wade, and that's what they're campaigning on, while another presidential candidate is being maligned in another 30-second misleading ad by John McCain's campaign for trying to teach sex ed to fifth graders? Heard Tom Hartman talking to Terry Jeffries about this yesterday. Really? No, it's predator education, and every kid should have it. This is where we are right now. Those issues aren't being discussed. What we're seeing is the same as we saw with Mike Dukakis and the Willie Horton 30-second ad. Mike Dukakis and the photograph of him in a tank. Harold Ford, as he was running for senator in Tennessee with a white women ad in a 30-second ad. Max Cleland, when he was running in Georgia, when he was accused of being like Osama bin Laden in a 30-second TV ad, while he's a triple amputee because of what he faced in Vietnam. John Kerry, his kite surfing ad. He's French. And, of course, the ketchup heiress he was married to. How is that any different than what we're seeing today with Barack Obama, with the sex ed for five-year-olds ad and the lipstick on a pig feigned outrage? The reality of a low-information voter that a lot of the talking heads are spouting off about right now, the reality of this low-information voter is that it's really created by a low-information media. We're all watching. I mean, you've seen the ratings for the acceptance speeches of Barack Obama, Sarah Palin, and John McCain. We're all watching. After all, it's the best reality TV show going this year. It makes Big Brother look like paint drying. So why is it then that the media continues to insist that issues will only be included in 30-second spots bought by politicians who will sell their souls? We should be giving it away. This is the revolution. It will not be televised. It is your television. I'm Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. And here's my point. I don't know about September 11th, and I know you don't know any more than I do, unless your last name is Tenet or Bush or Cheney. So I wanted to take a look at one thing I do know. It's about the media. And as long as money is equated to free speech and corporations are viewed as people, and as long as the media demands that free speech, that money, in order for any voter to hear a candidate's side of the issue, listen, we will remain the very definition of insane. We will do the same thing every campaign over and over again and expect different results. We are on the verge of repeating what happened 4 years ago, where we elected the guy who we wanted to have a beer with but wouldn't know the difference between pressing the red button or the blue button, but he would pretty well think he'd probably want to press all the buttons. Here we are again with Sarah Palin, the moose-eating hockey mom, being who everybody understands, but Barack Obama is an elitist from the south side of Chicago. He is exotic because of the color of his skin. We've got to change the way campaigns are run, and I'm talking about opening up the media spigots and letting it out. The media actually budgets their campaign cash, and campaign years are boons for media outlets. It's got to stop. The media is yours. The government is ours. Therefore, we should turn the media over to politicians so they have that forum and it's not confined to 30 seconds and they don't have to sell their soul in order to get it. After all, when you look at what is being spun right now by the two presidential campaigns, what do all these lies say about John McCain? And everybody's come forward at this point in the media and said what John McCain is saying is a lie, but it hasn't stopped the media from reporting a lie. Do all these lies being spread by the McCain campaign suggest that he would be an above-the-board president, that he'd be holier than thou, that he would hold the virtues that he's campaigning on? The idea, what do all these lies about Barack Obama say about John McCain, for starters?
Senator Obama will raise taxes on small businesses, and he refuses to drill offshore. So it's time to leave the talk behind and start shaking up Washington.
From yesterday's campaign trail, where John McCain was alone without Sarah Palin for the first time since the convention, and you could hear his crowd in the background clearly chanting McCain. Right. The idea that Barack Obama wants to raise your taxes, well, that is only true if you're a corporation not paying any taxes or you're the wealthiest 1%, who John McCain is. So for John McCain, it does apply. What about the lie that Barack Obama never authored a piece of legislation? That's a lie. What about the fact that he never reached across the aisle? I seem to remember when he got into the U.S. Senate, Barack Obama reached across the aisle to Dick Lugar in Indiana, Republican U.S. Senator, to try to procure and rein in loose nukes from the former Soviet Union. What about the idea that Barack Obama has never bucked his own party? Well, that would not be true because for the Cadillac version of ethics reform that was introduced in the U.S. Senate, sponsored by Barack Obama, he had to face his own party in order to get it passed. What about the fact that Barack Obama wants to teach sex ed to five-year-olds in kindergarten? Well, we all know that's a lie. And now Barack Obama is being accused of lying about Sarah Palin, and the citation that John McCain uses is from factcheck.org. If you go to factcheck.org, it's actually John McCain lying about Obama lying about Sarah Palin. And what about the lies regarding Sarah Palin? Not the conjecture, but the lies, the ones we know are not true. Like that bridge to nowhere, which Sarah Palin stood up for in her gubernatorial debate in Alaska.
I'm not going to stand in the way of progress that our congressional delegation, in the position of strength that they have right now, they're making those efforts for the state of Alaska to build up our infrastructure. I would not get in the way of progress.
What about the fact that she hired indicted Senator Ted Stevens' lobbyists so she could procure earmarks for the state of Alaska and her city of Wasilla?
I'm not going to stand in the way of progress that our congressional delegation, in the position of strength that they have right now, they're making those efforts for the state of Alaska to build up our infrastructure. I would not get in the way of progress.
What do the lies say about John McCain and Sarah Palin? That they will reign with virtue if they get into the White House? What are the lies about Sarah? What about the lie that Sarah Palin sold that state jet on eBay? That's not true. That's not true. No, she put it up for bid on eBay, but nobody wanted a state jet, so they took it off of eBay. What about the idea that Sarah Palin has the foreign policy experience to step in if she were a heartbeat away from the president? Yeah, because, you know, Alaska's right there next to Russia, and that was exactly the same foreign policy experience George W. Bush had as governor, where he was right next to Mexico. So he was ready from day one, and certainly ready on September 11th. My pet goat, anyone? What about these lies? In the midst of the time when we should be talking about taxes and health care, Social Security and education, Iraq and Afghanistan, Iran and North Korea, Roe v. Wade, where we have gone now and the media has allowed it to perpetuate is the truth at this point is little more than a strategy for the Republican Party, specifically for John McCain. The truth, that doesn't matter. The reality is that reality itself has become a campaign tool. And the facts are never as important as the cause itself. In other words, the ends justify the means. What have we seen with the last 8 years with our curbing of our civil liberties and the unjustifiable occupation of Iraq? The ends justify the means. How can you argue that John McCain and Sarah Palin would legislate, would govern any differently? The way John McCain is lying about Barack Obama is the same way Sarah Palin is lying about Sarah Palin. It's the same way Fox News is lying about its enemies, both perceived and real. It's the same way the religious right is lying about to the masses about the intent and the will of their God. It's the same way that Enron made their billions. It's the same way ExxonMobil made record profits, world record profits, the likes of which never seen before. And it is, we are doomed to repeat this unless we change this. And if we expect difference, something different while doing the same thing year in and year out, well, that is the definition of insane. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio at 866-303-2270. My next guest is the Associate Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, located in Madison, where I'm broadcasting from the Air America affiliate, the Mike 92.1, online at prwatch.org. Please welcome Associate Director Judith Sears-Pazon. Good morning, or good afternoon. What time of day are we in?
How about good lunchtime?
Good day, Judith.
And
I want to thank you
me.
For being here because you have an upcoming chapter in the new book put out annually by Project Censored. It has to do with Gardasil.
Right, the Gardasil cell job.
The Gardasil cell job, which I had talked to you personally about, I don't know, a year ago about
Close
this?
Close to a year ago, probably.
And then all of a sudden, about a month ago, the same thing that you told me over a year ago started making it into the mainstream media.
Finally.
What is Gardasil? What is it supposed to do? And what does it do?
Sure. Gardasil is a vaccine put out by Merck, and it is often portrayed as a vaccine against cancer, which is far from totally accurate. What it is a vaccine against human papilloma virus, or HPV. There are researchers say between 100 and 200 different strains of HPV. Many of them are nothing to worry about. Almost everyone in their lives will have HPV. Their body will clear it, just like a cold, actually, and they won't even know that they had it. There are a few high-risk strains that can cause some cell abnormalities in the cervical area, especially. There are four high-risk strains. Gardasil guards against two of those four high-risk strains and then also two other strains that can cause genital warts. But what's really important to understand is that this shortcut of it being a vaccine against cancer is really not accurate. HPV can cause some cell abnormalities. Those cell abnormalities, if they're not caught, and a pap smear catches almost all of them, if they're not caught, they can then develop into further dysplasia, cell abnormalities, which can eventually, and often it takes about a decade to do this, can turn into a cervical cancer condition.
Judith Sears-Pazon, so Gardasil is supposed to guard against cervical cancers at the end of it.
Right.
But only a half of the strains that can lead to HPV that can lead to cervical cancer.
Exactly. And optimistically, probably it could protect against about 70% of those infections that could eventually lead to cervical cancer. But another thing to keep in mind is that while it protects against two out of those four strains, it's completely unknown at this point what those other two strains might get up to if the other ones are basically out of competition. So there is a risk, and a lot of medical doctors are saying, we don't know what's going to happen with those other two strains. They might become more powerful, and we don't have anything to protect against those.
What was the campaign slogan that Merck rolled out when they rolled out Gardasil?
Oh, there were several. They actually started an ad campaign long before they even had FDA approval. It didn't have the Gardasil name on it, but it created this culture of fear and urgency about cervical cancer, which, lo and behold, just when kind of the uproar was at its peak, they rolled out Gardasil. Like, you know, the miracle vaccine.
Well, where does, Judith, where does cervical cancer rank in terms of health dangers for women?
Pretty low. It's not even in the top 10 cancers that kill the most women. And any cancer, breast and lung being the highest mortality rates for women, those even pale in comparison to heart disease and things like stroke. So cervical cancer in the developed world, and that's a really key thing, is really not a crisis. It's been declining steadily over the years. The Pap smear has been around for something like 60 years, and they've seen large percentage drops in cervical cancer deaths each year. In the U.S., we see probably 3,700 women a year die from cervical cancer out of a population of close to 300 million.
But Judith Sears-Pazon, Merck has created a vaccine for a cancer, albeit minor. You would think that would be a cause for celebration, but what we saw with the rollout of Gardasil were political movements to mandate Gardasil inoculations or vaccinations, probably most famously with a Governor Perry from Texas.
Right.
And
Good
it was
Hair
weird
Perry.
To see Good Hair Perry yeah. down in Texas, the Republican, extolling the virtues of cervical cancer vaccine.
Yeah, and it was surprising until you found out all the connections that Perry has with Merck, the money that he's gotten from them. His wife and his mother-in-law both connected to an organization called Women in Government that is heavily funded by many industries, but very prominently by pharmaceuticals, who are not coincidentally pushing for a mandate. Merck was so heavy-handed with this because they had and have, for the moment, a corner on the market. There is no other FDA-approved vaccine in the United States, so as many jabs as Merck can get into young girls' arms, the more money they're making. And they're estimating a couple billion dollars this year alone.
Just in the
Gardasil? Just in Gardasil, yeah.
Billion. A B.
Billion with a B.
Judith Sears-Pazon is the Associate Director for the Center for Media and Democracy online at prwatch.org. She has the quintessential work on Gardasil and the Merck's push to make sure every child gets Gardasil. But what about the efficacy of Gardasil and what about the cost effectiveness and efficacy, Judith?
There are a lot of questions. One question is whether a booster is going to be needed or not. And what was interesting in the drug trials, they really focused on girls and women in their mid to late teens. All of a sudden, when it started getting pushed for mandates, they were targeting 9 to 12-year-olds.
Right.
And their idea, which there's a kernel of truth, as there often is in pretty funky explanations. The kernel of truth is that Gardasil or any HPV vaccine is most effective if it's given before sexual activity starts. Because once you've been infected by a strain of HPV,
the vaccine doesn't
work. So,
right.
So as you get older and as chances increase that you're sexually active, it has less and less efficacy. There are a couple risks. One is that a booster, if it's needed, and some people are saying it looks like a booster might be needed as soon as 5 years.
So this vaccine wears off.
Quite possibly. Again, they rushed it so much that it's hard to tell. But it's possible that a booster could be needed just when a lot of young women are becoming sexually active. And they will think, oh, yeah, I remember getting those three shots, because it's a series of three shots. I got those three shots, you know, when I was in seventh grade, so I don't have to worry. They might be relying on it just when they need it most and just when the efficacy is wearing off. Another thing that researchers have said is that there is actually no proof being, you know, a very important scientific concept. There is no proof that this is going to decrease cervical cancer because it takes so long to develop. They haven't been able to follow girls and women who have gotten the shot long enough to see if the ones that get the shot have a lower rate of cervical cancer.
So what were the FDA trials for?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think
let me guess to an answer here, Judith. Marketing.
You know, it's really interesting. They fast-tracked the approval of Gardasil, although Merck will say, oh, no, you know, it was not fast-tracked. Well, what happened was it was approved after about 5 years of testing, which seems to be fairly normal, but it was approved in only a few months. That part of the process usually takes 3 years. And then it's usually another 5 to 10 years before, like, the vaccine board recommends it for all children. That was done 2 weeks after the FDA approval.
And we know that the marketing campaign started before the
FDA approval. Exactly. And, you know, so you have, I mean, really, you have to hand it to Merck, whether you want to or not. I mean, they came at this. They knew that they have this window of opportunity. GlaxoSmithKline does have a competing vaccine, but it has not been approved in the U.S. It's being used in many other countries. But they knew they had this very finite window of opportunity to sell their vaccine.
And have a monopoly.
And have a monopoly, and they spared no expense. They put together this several-tiered advertising campaign. Most people, I'm sure, have seen the One Less commercials,
yep,
which have now, that was actually the fourth stage of
don't
the advertising.
Don't they have little rubber wristbands for
they
that,
have wristbands.
Too? What color
actually,
are they?
It's not rubber. They're beaded, and
oh,
yeah, they're
oh,
much more feminine.
Oh, One Less.
So One Less commercials were the huge one that debuted right after FDA approval. That's morphed into I Chose, which there are several variations of that. Some
and they have I Chose bracelets too, I hope?
I think it's a one campaign fits all bracelet. But they it has mothers saying, I chose to have my daughter vaccinated, blah, blah, blah. It has, again, the very empowering images of girls.
Stop right there. Judith Sears Pazon, if you had a kid, daughter, 9 to 15 years old.
I do. I have a 14-year-old.
You have a 14-year-old daughter.
I do.
She is on the verge of all the teenage angst and, you know,
no, no.
You know, Mom. So I'll ask you, as her mother, what do you advise your daughter to do?
She actually had her, you know, like yearly checkup, and they offered the vaccine. And we said, you know, we're going to wait and see. I think what's really critical to point out, Lee, is that this is not a crisis in the United States or in Canada or in Great Britain. It's a crisis in Africa where women do not receive any kind of health care from basically the day they're born.
But Merck's not going to make billions with
exactly.
a B in Africa.
Exactly. And the problem is, you know, they're looking. So let me finish your question.
Yeah.
Actually, we decided to take a wait and see approach. When she had her appointment, it was not clear whether the competing vaccine was going to be on the market soon. It's not going to be for probably at least another year. But I think what's really important is that this is not a magic bullet. And while my daughter would know that, because we will hammer it into her malleable mind, that she has to get pap smear, she has to, you know, do all the other things, that the vaccine might be an additional thing. There's no rush to do this. And I think there are just too many questions. And I have to say, Merck is the one that has muddied the water on this. Their greed just really eliminated any of the benefit that this could have been.
And you are saying there could be benefit here.
Mm-hmm.
And Judith,
absolutely.
I think, you know, I did a quick precursory search on news.google.com
mm-hmm.
for Gardasil.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first stories that comes up are the allegations of a connection between certain casualties, deaths,
yes.
and the association with Gardasil. Is Gardasil killing?
You know, I'm not a medical professional, and so I tend to try not to wade into those things too much. I think the concern with any vaccine, whether it's Gardasil or another newly developed vaccine, is that when it's new, there are just too many unknowns, and that's natural and understandable. But when you try to do mass vaccinations and mandate vaccinations of an entire chunk of our population, that's really concerning, because often it takes a few years to be able to compare people who got it, people who didn't, death
right.
rates, things like
right.
that. I don't see a lot that says that this is any more dangerous than a lot of new drugs, new vaccines. But we've also seen, for instance, with Merck, you know, they not only chose not to tell, but they literally hid results of people dying from their drug Vioxx. And they were fined for that, and they're being sued in the billions and probably close to trillions of dollars. So I personally don't trust that Merck is going to tell us if they find some little problematic things with their brand new vaccine, quote unquote, against cancer.
And one of the other scary parts of this is the relationship that Merck has built with our government.
Absolutely.
In order to promote and market Gardasil, an HPV vaccine, but it only prevents or is a vaccine for two of the four dangerous HPV viruses. My guest is Judith Sears-Poisson. She's Associate Director of the Center for Media and Democracy online at PRWatch.org. Her story on Gardasil and the pushing and marketing of Gardasil will be featured in the upcoming Project Censored book put out annually. Do you know what chapter it is?
I don't.
It's 46 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman today. Our conversation with Judith continues next. If you have a question for Judith, 866-303-2270. Sitting in for Tom Hartman today, what are you going to do about your daughter? My name is Lee Rayburn. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. My guest is Judith Sears-Poisson. She is the Associate Director of the Center for Media and Democracy online at PRWatch.org. Her investigation into the marketing of Gardasil will be featured in the upcoming Project Censored book. And Judith, before the break, we were talking about Good Hair Perry, the governor of Texas, who was at one point mandating or thinking about mandating Gardasil for all.
He did mandate it, and then the Texas legislature overturned it.
But there is a bigger scope of the relationship between Merck and government and the marketing of Gardasil.
Right. I mean, it's really important to know that in the United States, it's at the state level that vaccines can be mandated. So you're looking at potentially 50 and plus, if you count the territories, 50 plus different interpretations of mandates, decisions about mandates, and places that need to be convinced to mandate if you're an organization like Merck. The best way that they found they could do that was to go to networks of state level legislators. One that really took the ball and ran with it on Gardasil was the Women in Government Group, which is, as it sounds, a network of women state legislators. And Merck and other pharmaceutical companies as well, and many other things like casinos, telecoms, basically everyone that could be helped or hurt by state-level legislation.
Everybody that could afford to buy a state legislator.
And they basically bought access to the legislators. The money didn't go directly to the legislators, but it went to women in government who had things like a business roundtable where the women legislators could get, you know, really important information from these companies who, what a surprise, would benefit from them voting one way or another. And it was through that that they really pushed for the mandate of the Gardasil vaccine or of an HPV vaccine. But as we know, Gardasil is the only one on the market here.
Let's go to the phones here. Lori in Seattle, you are on Air America Radio with Judith Sears-Poisson.
Hi, I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller, and I just want to talk a little bit about what was said earlier about how cervical cancer is uncommon. And I think listeners may have gotten the impression that this isn't a vaccine that's worth having, you know, available. And I just think that's not true. I'm a pharmacist that's worked in a cancer center for a big part of my career. So, you know, I've worked with women with cervical cancer. I've seen how horrible a disease it is. And I'll also tell you that I had cervical cancer when I was 25. I wish I had been, you know, Gardasil had been around when I was a teenager because it might have prevented me from going through what I had to go through. I do have a daughter now, and I'm very lucky because, like I said, when I was 25, one of my options was to have a hysterectomy because of, you know, what this adenocarcinoma that I had. And, you know, my daughter will be getting the vaccine. I just think, I don't think it needs to be mandated, but I think it needs to be an option.
Thank you, Lori.
And Lori, I just want to say that I absolutely agree with you. I think it should be available. But there's a big difference between available and mandated, and it sounds like you're...
I think you guys are on the same page. The difference here is that what we have seen so far is a marketing campaign for Gardasil. Again, not the issues and not the truth, not the facts and not the science, but a marketing campaign, a spin campaign, which includes the buying and selling off of our state legislators.
And I think that making it available is great, but to make it available while at the same time, creating this culture of panic and fear.
Yes.
And I have to say, like, some pretty heavy duty guilt. Like, if you don't do anything you can to get your daughter vaccinated, you're negligent. And let's face facts. I mean, a lot of people in this country don't have health insurance. A lot of people fall between, you know, the abject poverty where you can access government health insurance and, you know, those of us that are lucky to have good health insurance. The series of three shots initially, they like to say it has a price tag of about $450 total, but that's the actual vaccine. When you add in things like the office visits and the overhead of the clinic or the doctor's office that you're going to, it can be up to $1,000 for the series of three shots.
I can get a filling for that. Let's go to Richard in San Francisco. Richard, you're on Air America Radio with Judith Sears-Pazon.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard DeAndrea. I'd just like to make a couple of comments. First off, if it's okay for me to make a couple of comments, is that all right with you guys?
Yeah, please go ahead, Doc.
Okay. I'm a physician, have been a physician for 16 years. A colleague of mine was nominated for a Nobel Prize in Medicine. His name is Dr. William Pitt, for helping create the Pap smear with Dr. Papanicolaou. When I discussed this particular subject with him individually, he is an allergist and an immunologist. He says that specifically we should be looking at what's in these vaccines, including mercury, formaldehyde, embryonic fetal tissue, live and activated cell tissue, which can also transfer genetic codes to different tissue in the body. If the young lady before this wants to know the answer to cervical cancer, since we are 20 years behind in medicine in this country, we should be looking at what they're doing in Europe. We would call it ozone insufflation, which can be put directly over the cervical tissue and cause the cancer to stop growing. Although these oxygen therapies are very available and known, we can't get them past lobbyists in Washington because the pharmaceutical companies have locked everything up. You are now existing in a country that just does pharmaceutical medicine.
Yeah.
There are one-third of physicians in the United States do not give immunizations to their children. Not one single child I have ever treated, I have recommended immunizations.
Doctor, I apologize. We're up against a break here, but I want to thank you for the information.
That was very helpful.
Judith Sears-Pazon, I want to thank you for bringing us something that wasn't a marketing campaign about Gardasil.
Sure.
I want to remind folks they can find out this information online at prwatch.org. And check out Judith's new chapter in the upcoming Project Censored book, out in just a couple of weeks, regarding the marketing of Gardasil. Judith Sears-Pazon, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Lee.
Coming up next, we've got a story you're not going to want to miss. It has to do with the election, November, and your vote. It may be missing. Did you know that? Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My name is Lee Rayburn, broadcasting from the Air America affiliate, the Mike 92.1 in Madison, Wisconsin. And of all the scary stories today, the scariest is the next one I'll tell you. Sure, there is the story out today how this is National Suicide Prevention Week, and suicide attempts for veterans have jumped 500% in 5 years. 500% in 5 years, and the government's not doing anything about it. Sure, there is a story of trading sex and cocaine for oil in the Denver Interior Department and in Washington, trading sex and coke for oil? Really? Has oil gotten that precious? The Denver Minerals Management Service office responsible for marketing the oil and gas that energy companies barter to the government instead of making cash royalty payments for drilling on federal lands has now been caught up in this sex and drug scandal, also with a quid pro quo scandal. It looks like these employees of the Interior Department of the federal government, our employees, were actually also working on the side as oil consultants. But that's not the scariest story I heard today. The scariest story I heard today was on my little old morning show in Madison, Wisconsin. It started with a phone call. And that phone call was like, hey, Lee, I was just wondering if you know anything about these absentee ballots I'm getting in the mail. And, of course, I didn't. So I said no, but we'll throw it out there. And here's the beauty of local progressive talk is that before you knew it, I had a slew of calls, a whole page of emails about people who had received absentee ballots by mail, who were progressive radio listeners, who were registered Democrats, who got the absentee ballot from the McCain campaign. All of a sudden, red flags started going off all over the city. What the heck is going on? Even my boss here at the Mike 92.1 in Madison received two absentee ballots in the mail from John McCain, and there is something fishy going on. You may remember the stories of caging that took place 4 years ago, where the Republican Party decided they would throw out their official mail that if it got returned to sender, well, then they would use that as evidence that that voter is either voting fraudulently or no longer lives in the precinct and therefore should be dropped from the voter rolls, which we saw by the thousands 4 years ago. We may be seeing it by the hundreds of thousands this year. Because the more I look into what was just this morning a little small local story about John McCain trying to mislead Democratic voters in my community, all of a sudden, you started to notice the stories nationwide. And I have in my hand a copy, and here's how it works. I have in my hand a copy of the mailer that was sent to one of my listeners in Madison, Wisconsin. It is a mailer for John McCain with two applications for absentee ballots attached. And the funny thing about it all is that the mailer for these absentee ballots, they have the return address absentee ballot request card. But instead of going to the city clerk's office in Madison, where this listener will be voting, they go to the city clerk's office in Mayville, Wisconsin, and I gotta tell you, I don't even know where that is. You start to begin to see that there is a trend going on, not just in Wisconsin, a purple state. Here's another email I got this morning, and the reason I put this out here is because I want to know from you. Have you received an absentee ballot or two from John McCain's campaign? 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. I want to hear from you if you got one, because this goes to the heart of what the McCain campaign is spending their money on and spending it wisely. I'm trying to make sure you don't vote in November. Here's another email I got from Ann this morning. Hey, Lee, I just got off the phone with my friend in Illinois. He and his wife just moved from Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, to Oak Park, Illinois. Interestingly enough, Lee, he received some mail from our friend John McCain yesterday. It had a postcard with a bunch of positive facts about John McCain and also attached two absentee ballots for Wisconsin. There is a lot of speculation going on right now because a lot of my listeners, and including my own boss, has received an absentee ballot in the mail from John McCain. There is speculation that this may be caging. There is speculation that these absentee ballots, if they are returned en masse, may be used as evidence, uncredible albeit, but evidence that voter fraud took place rampantly from Obama supporters. Here's this Obama supporter, just taking this email, for example. Here's this Obama supporter that lived in Illinois, Oak Park, Illinois, and voted absentee in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. Here is another absentee voter, just using the flyer that I got from a listener today, who lives on Forest Run Court in Madison, but she filed her absentee ballot with the city clerk of Mayville, not Madison, Wisconsin. Have you seen this yet? 866-303-2270, because I'm dying to find out how rampant this is. Right now, Wisconsin is a veritable dead heat for the presidential race. And we are one of a handful of states that way, maybe about a half dozen. We tend to be leaning towards Obama. However, if every registered Democratic voter in Wisconsin is going to be receiving a misleading absentee ballot from John McCain, what do you think that says about John McCain's odds in my home state? And then what do you think that says about John McCain's odds in your home state? Hello, Florida! Public radio in Florida is now warning their listeners that voter caging is taking place by the McCain campaign, specifically focused on so-called snowbirds. You know, folks from my backyard here in Wisconsin that choose to bypass winters by spending them down in Florida. McCain's campaign is now sending people unsolicited absentee ballot requests, according to Florida Public Radio, focusing on snowbirds that will be used as possible caging. Here is the letter. One example in Florida from WGCU. The mail brought a two-page letter from John McCain stating I was a registered Republican and I needed to send them the affirmation that I was indeed registered and I was indeed living there. Curiously, the date on the letter was only listed as, quote, Monday morning. The front of the letter read, do not forward. So this person called the post office in Florida and says, what happens if the letter is sent to me with a do not forward message and I'm up north for a few months? Well, he said it goes directly to the shipper as undeliverable. That is how caging is done. and it is being focused right now in Wisconsin because it's a veritable dead heat with Barack Obama holding a little bit of a lead. However, if they could drop 100,000 people off the voter rolls between now and November, or if they could create evidence of voter fraud between now and November by issuing these misleading absentee ballot application forms that will be going to the wrong city clerk's office, have been mailed to the wrong addresses. And I got about a half dozen calls over the last couple days on this story. Have you seen it? Because if you have, then what we are seeing is a subversion of our democratic process. This is not trying to validate Republican voters. These aren't Republicans that are receiving John McCain's absentee ballots. It's not like John McCain wants to make sure every Barack Obama supporter gets out and votes on Election Day. That is far from the truth. Alternate.org has a further explanation of the story today, and it goes even deeper. In New Jersey, state officials told 300,000 people that they were not registered to vote. New reports say an unknown number of those contacted were properly registered, however. In Florida, the Republican Secretary of State there, Kurt Browning, this week announced that he would resume enforcing the same controversial state law that voting rights lawyers say has kicked off 14,000 people of color from the voter rolls since 2006. Well, that's not as bad as 2000, but it still ain't democracy. In Virginia, another veritable dead heat and purple state. The story out of Channel 7, WDBJ in Roanoke, Virginia, cites again a mailer that is being sent around from the McCain campaign focused on Democratic voters to submit an absentee ballot. A ballot that was never requested but sent anyway to Democratic voters. And this type of mailer is not illegal per se. What they do with it may be. Election officials say the instruction page that has been created is critical in making sure voters fill out the application correctly so it won't be denied. However, when you're putting the wrong city clerk's office on to submit the absentee ballot to, when you are sending it to, when you are sending the voter registration or the absentee ballot registration to a new address, but sending it off to the city clerk at their old address, what do you think John McCain's campaign is doing? Also in Virginia, students who register to vote now are facing a new state rule, ambiguous at best, where 2 weeks ago, the county election director in Montgomery County, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is, told students who register to vote in Virginia they could no longer be claimed as dependents on their parents' tax returns if they decided to be vote in their campus, in their college town. The IRS has said that is a lie. In Michigan, the chairman of the GOP in Macomb County, one of three counties in the Detroit metro area, said he's going to challenge the right of people to vote if they've been evicted from their foreclosed homes. Well, there were nearly 2,000 foreclosure filings in July alone in that area, putting it at the top three counties in the country losing homes right now. And those people, while losing homes, should not lose their right to vote. But they are. Have you seen this story yet? Because this may be the story of the election. Screw the whole idea of lipstick on a pig. This is a subversion of our democracy. 866-303-2270. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Please, if you have heard about this, let me know. We need to let others know as well. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
After the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. I broadcast locally with a morning show on the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mike 92.1. We opened up the phone lines yesterday or this morning. It all runs together. And what we found out was that there are a number of listeners to the show who are Barack Obama supporters. And I think they were all registered Democratic voters, I think. We don't have to register as Democrat or Republican in the state of Wisconsin. But they were receiving absentee ballots from John McCain. The thing is, they were unclear. The thing is that some of them had the wrong city clerk to mail the absentee ballots to. The thing is, some of these absentee ballots were mailed to new addresses where people had moved and registered, but were sent to the old addresses where they were. Speculation here is rampant that this could be voter caging, that they could be trying to suppress the voter turnout in November, particularly in purple states, that they could be trying to lose the vote of these people who will take John McCain's campaign absentee ballot application and send it back to the wrong city clerk per the address. I mean, I've got a copy of it right here. They are misleading. They are lying. But this is just par for the course. Have you seen it? I want to hear from you. Let's start in Don, who's in Cape Coral, Florida. Don, you're on Air America Radio.
Hi there. Yes, I did receive one of these applications at my home address in Cape Coral.
And?
I haven't done anything with it yet.
Don, here's what I need you to do. Is I don't know if you have a government accountability board there. You need to take this to your city clerk's office. You need to show them that, I mean, are you a Barack Obama supporter? Are you a registered Democrat?
Yes, I am.
You need to let people know because, and I don't, do you have any speculation as to why you would have received such a thing from the McCain campaign?
Well, I did register for an absentee ballot during the last local election.
But that was the last, not this election, you didn't register for one.
No.
Well, I would recommend, Don, and I'm not you, but I would recommend you don't use it, but you take it and turn it into the city clerk's office. Do you ever go away for the winter? Do you leave for the summer? Is this a part-time home for you, Don?
No, it isn't. This has been my residence for years.
Have you heard any other of your friends getting absentee ballots in Cape Coral?
No, I was quite irritated when I received it because being a registered Democrat, I'm not expecting anything from
Does
John
it go
McCain.
Back to the Cape Coral? Does it return address to Cape Coral?
Yes, it goes to the address is County Supervisor of Elections, Post Office Box 2545, Fort Myers, Florida.
I would even wonder, sir, if that P.O. box number is correct.
I have the thing, and I haven't called yet, but I'd meant to. And when I heard you on the radio,
I want to thank you for telling me about it and do your part by turning it in. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Ronnie in Pennsylvania, another purple state. Ronnie, you're on Air America Radio.
Yeah, hi. I was listening here at work, and when I heard this, I had to go out in the hall and try to call because I'm very sad about this. I am an Obama supporter. I'm working for the campaign this year, and my two kids are away at college, and when I received this, I was going to get them absentee ballots, and I saw it, and I go, oh, he saved me the trouble, and it was kind of ironic. But this is unbelievable. With all of the distractions that have been going on in the news and them staying away from the real issues and tying up everything with nonsense, and then if they cannot win, honestly, in a true American way, especially on a day like this to find out news of this type of thing, and if this is happening and, you know, a small town like where I live in and other places to registered voters that care enough to go to the polls, it's just a crime. And I hope this is something that people talk to everybody about and find out the scale and the scope of this and get it out in the open so it can be exposed, because this is just horrible.
Ronnie, I think I would hope that you would turn this information over to your local city clerks or your government accountability board or your ethics board. Because people need to know that registered Democrats are receiving absentee ballot applications from John McCain that are either misleading, that are misaddressed, or the return address is inaccurate, or the instructions are unclear. And it is not clear to me. I don't claim to know what the hell is going on here. But something is happening, and it ain't democracy. And what we need to do is show John McCain what democracy looks like.
It's so very sad that winning comes at a cost of what our country was built on, and the compromise to win like this is just, I'd be embarrassed.
And yet, Ronnie, it's par for the course. It's what we saw 4 years ago in Ohio, 8 years ago in Florida, and what we will see in 2008 in Wisconsin so far, what we've seen we've heard in Florida so far, in Pennsylvania so far. Do you see a trend here? Purple state, purple state, purple state. That John McCain's campaign is obviously focused on registered Democratic voters in purple states. I have not received the John McCain absentee ballot application because I'm not a Democrat. But my assumption here is that how many purple states and how many registered Democrats in purple states, how many Barack Obama supporters are getting these misleading absentee ballot forms? I want to keep up on this. So if you have received one, I want to hear from you. 866-303-2270. I want to find out if this is happening in red states or blue states. Hell, we're all the United States. But we are in danger of losing that if we lose this election. And I'm not saying losing the election to John McCain. I'm saying losing the election to a subversion of our democracy. I don't care if, I mean, I do care if John McCain wins or loses. But if he wins by getting the votes and counting the votes, that's one thing. If he wins by subverting the vote, well, that is not democracy. And that demands an equal and opposite reaction. And that reaction, I could only say, would be revolution, one form or another. Show me what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. 27 minutes after the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. 866-303-2270. We will continue with your calls next on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio at 866-303-2270. While the media continues to follow the ruse that is lipstick on a pig. I'm sorry, what's that again?
You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
Yeah, say it one more time.
You can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig, in my view.
You want to say it again?
I think they put some lipstick on the pig, but it's still a pig.
Is there any other chance you might have said that before?
I don't like to use this term, yeah. But the latest proposal I see is putting lipstick on a pig.
While the media is following that brouhaha, there is a story brewing nationwide in each and every purple state from across the country. I just received this in my inbox from Nastia. Lee, my husband received one of these McCain ballots in the mail a few weeks ago. He's a registered independent in Florida, but we live in California because he's in the military, so he always votes absentee. And he has not voted for a Republican in years. When he got home from the deployment, I showed him this ballot and raised a concern about caging. I don't know what he did with it, and he's in a meeting at work right now, but I can't contact him. This is happening in Florida. This is happening in Pennsylvania, and the way this story started was I started hearing reports of John McCain sending registered Democratic voters and Obama supporters absentee ballots by mail here in my home state of Wisconsin, a purple state. And that these absentee ballots in some ways have been they have included multiple absentee ballots. The return address has been wrong. The sender address has been a new address, while the city clerk's return address has been from their old city clerk's office. That there are certain misleading things about these John McCain mailers, which include absentee ballot applications, which would suggest, dare I say it, fraud. There's another word for it, too. It's called a lie, but we would never put that past a former prisoner of war now, would we? Have you come across these absentee ballots? Are you a Barack Obama supporter that was curious to know why John McCain was so interested to make sure that your vote counted? Think again. Let's go to Letty in Illinois. Letty, you're on Air America Radio.
Yeah, really, I think that you should be explaining what absentee ballots are, or ballotees,
well,
whatever.
If you're not going to be at your polling place on Election Day, you can request an absentee ballot and vote ahead of time.
Okay. All right. Well, see, the thing is, I'm right now a community organizer trying to get as many people in Missouri to turn Missouri into a blue state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our ultimate goal. We're trying to get 6,000 people around the St. Louis metro area.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people are like coming up to me. They're like, oh, I'm doing absentee ballots. And I was like, I don't really understand, you know, what the absentee ballot is. And so now I do understand because these people are McCain voters.
Ah.
Yeah, and now because I went to Washington University, the pharmacy school.
Sure.
And a lot of these people say that they don't want Obama because they are going to school to be pharmacists, which means that he supports universal health care.
Oh, yeah, the government-run pharmacies.
Yeah, so... So I thought that was kind of interesting, but I didn't understand, so I had to ask somebody like
I appreciate it, Letty, and there is nothing wrong with voting absentee. However, red flags are raised when your opponent's candidate, knowing that you as a voter are opposed to his candidacy, sends you an absentee ballot and pretends like he's committed to making sure your vote counts. When the return address to the city clerk's office is wrong, or when they're using a former address – of yours, and they are most likely, it seems to me, and I don't want to say this is how it is, because I still can't see through all the lies and deception here. It looks like they are trying to make sure either your vote gets lost in the mail, sent to the wrong city clerk's office, or they can use it to prop up allegations of voter fraud in the event that Barack Obama wins in November. That is my best guess, but I'm all ears if you have something similar at 866-303-2270. We go to Karen in Alameda, California. Karen, you're on Air America Radio.
Hi. Yeah, I am an officer of the Alameda Democratic Club, and we do a lot of voter registration. And I would recommend to anybody who's having trouble as an individual, they have no leverage, particularly in Florida, which is a red state, I would not go to an official.
Really?
Complain. No, because they could be McCain supporters.
They could be Catherine Harris.
Go to their Democratic parties.
Okay.
Have the local Democratic Party put out warnings. Let them collect all the irregularities.
Can I tell you my problem, Karen, is that I fear that the Democratic Party won't do anything with this.
The local, go to the Obama field offices and go to the, you know, official parties in Florida. No, don't stop at one person.
You bet. Share this information with as many people as possible. You may want to call the media, too, and see if they're interested in a story that has something to do with something else besides.
You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
Thank you for the call, Tony. I'm sorry. Thank you for the call. Let's go now to Tony, who's in Ellen Park, Michigan. Tony, you're on Air America Radio.
Yes, I didn't receive anything in the mail, but I did get a recorded message of John McCain's voice on my phone.
And wait a minute, because I've heard this before. There have been robocalls from John McCain going around asking if you were interested in an absentee ballot.
No, this wasn't. They said they were mailing it to my address, and I would receive it in a week, in 1 to 2 weeks, and it will be sent back, postage paid, automatically to the National Republican Committee.
What?
Yes, and to me, this is national voter fraud.
I think this is either mail fraud or this is election fraud. Voter fraud is what they always allege against liberals, progressives, Democrats, that we vote early and vote often.
But the point is, I have an unlisted number.
You're kidding me.
My number is unlisted, and they don't even know I'm a Democrat or Republican.
So then how did they find you?
Well, I think they know where all of us are.
Oh, Tony! You just gave me the chills.
No, I'm not. I'm serious. My brother ran in an election for commissioner in River Rouge some 9 years ago, and there was voter fraud found there, and the FBI came in. And what had happened is they were collecting absentee ballots, and my brother won at the majority poll of 63% and lost to a 32% absentee ballot.
What?
Yes, sir.
That sounds like ballot stuffing.
Well, I don't know what you call it, but I don't know.
Well,
teaching math, I don't know how you can tell a student that a 62% majority poll can lose out to a 32%.
One thing we can agree on, what it's not, Tony, is democracy.
No, it's not, but this is national voter fraud, and the FBI should be called in and notified.
When you get your ballot from John McCain, you make sure to take it to as many people as possible. Please do.
Well, I'm going to call the Detroit News right away.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate the call and the footwork. We need to all put a little footwork in on this, because if you're not hearing, we have Michigan now, we have Pennsylvania now, we had Wisconsin today, we had Florida. These are where the absentee ballots from John McCain's campaign are being sent to Barack Obama supporters, Barack Obama voters. What does this mean? That John McCain wants to count every Barack Obama vote? Janice in Waterford, Michigan, you're on Air America Radio. I'm sorry. Let's move on here. Janice is gone, but she as well had received an absentee ballot in the mail. Jerry in Flint, Michigan, a lot of calls from Michigan at 866-303-2270. Jerry, what do you know?
Well, Lee, I haven't experienced the same thing. But obviously we've heard these kinds of stories before when Karl Rove has been involved in an election.
And what do we know about Karl Rove now? He's involved in the McCain campaign.
Absolutely. And I have a couple of points. Number one, you make such a good argument, in your presentation, but you're to the greatest extent, you are preaching to the choir. And my question is, you know, we need to get beyond the choir. So that's one question. How do we do that? And the other one is, you know, what you're saying is that, and I truly believe that we are headed towards exactly the same thing that we had in the other two elections, and that is voter fraud and manipulation of the count and that sort of thing. And so we're looking at another stolen election. We can't even trust the polls anymore. Because if it looks like they're real close, then a stolen election isn't very obvious. So here's my question on that, and that is, if we wait till the day after the election,
yeah,
and we all kind of go, gee, it was stolen, we won't have a reaction. Shouldn't we be making plans to take an action right after the election if we suspect this, and as part of those plans, not, you know, I'd be open to all sorts of suggestions, but a mobilization of Obama voters going to the federal capital and also or going to their state capitals, a huge nationwide march saying we will not take it this time. Two times is enough. Three times is ridiculous.
Yeah, Jerry, I appreciate the call. And first, getting past the choir is a struggle, because if this doesn't make the mainstream media, if this isn't included in the 6:30 evening news in a two-minute news story that includes three 15-second sound bites, it does not exist. It's like a tree falling in the forest with nobody there to hear it. The simple thing to do here, I think, is in each and every state, regardless of what color it is, and let's face it, they're all united, Barack says so, it's kind of why I like him, is that we all believe in democracy, right? What if Barack Obama were sending absentee ballots to John McCain supporters? What would the GOP, what would Rush Limbaugh say? What would Sean Hannity do? We all believe in democracy, right? We may have a difference of opinion as to what we should do with this damn thing, but we all believe in it. I mean, it's the one thing we all have in common. We're here because there is this country isn't a set of buildings that can be burned down. This country isn't a group of people that can be killed. This country is merely a set of ideas, and you can't kill it. You can't burn it down. You can't blow it up. And this idea right now, this democratic idea, is being attacked by the John McCain campaign. I think we've heard story after story, and we will finish the show with your stories at 866-303-2270. Are you a Barack Obama supporter that got an absentee ballot from John McCain? You should start asking yourself why and then asking everybody else as well. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's 50 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn. I want to let you know how humbling it is to be able to sit in for Tom Hartman today and thank Tom Hartman and everybody else at Air America Radio for giving me the best 3 hours of my day today, and I want to thank you for spending a little bit of it with me. I think the biggest story about our democracy today is not what anniversary we're commemorating, is not what the next storm is to hit our seaboard, but rather what is going to happen in November, and we are seeing it played out already in each and every purple state that I can think of. John McCain's campaign is sending out misleading absentee ballots to Barack Obama supporters. That's the story. Why is John McCain committed to sending absentee ballots to Barack Obama supporters? Do you really think it's because he wants every vote counted? Well, if it was, then he wouldn't be misleading folks about where to return the absentee ballots. He wouldn't be sending the new absentee ballots to people's new homes with city clerks' addresses of their old homes. This is not what democracy looks like. And we're just taking your calls because this is a story that started out in our local show here in Madison, Wisconsin this morning and has just grown in scope until we're finding the same story being told in every purple state so far. We go now to Mike in North Carolina. Mike, you're on Air America Radio.
Hi, Lee.
Hey.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, I got three of these.
Three?
Yeah.
Well, and you're not even in one of those purple states. You're in one of those United States.
Yeah, well, pretty red right now, but we're going to turn that.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. So one's a Democrat myself and an uncommitted spouse and a nephew that's I think he's a Republican. But anyway, all of us got one, and they say, you know, turn it in to, you know, the director of elections, and it gives the addresses a little different, where this in the phone book it's got a street address, and here they got a P.O. box.
That's the second time we've heard that today, Mike, and
yeah.
I'm wondering where that P.O. box goes.
Yeah, me too. I called the elections, and they said, you know, the guy didn't know what the information that I gave him, but it may have to go to the Justice Department in Raleigh.
Well, I tell you what, Mike, if you're up for it, just hand this information out to everybody who's interested, from the media to your elected officials to the Democratic Party in North Carolina where you are. Thank you for the call. We go now to Connie, who is in Huntington Beach, California. Lucky you, Connie. You're on Air America Radio.
Hi. I just want to talk a little bit about the applications for absentee ballot.
Okay.
Now, when you say that that McCain's campaign, you correctly, and most people don't do this, you correctly say that all of these people are getting applications for absentee.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you say McCain will send them an absentee ballot, that isn't correct. What he does is he will take the application. And what they're supposed to do, at least in California, what they're supposed to do is take your application for absentee. And in California, there's a 3-day law that they must get that application over to the county registrar of voters. And if they don't do it within 3 days, they're in trouble. Now, when they send you that application, there should be a stub that you take off. And that proves that you sent in your application.
Interesting, Connie, because, hold on, I'll let you continue, but I want to throw this in there. The story that we're getting here this afternoon is that exactly what you said, that these applications are going out to folks, but then the speculation is that, will they wait 3 days and let the application die?
That's what has happened years ago, and probably it happens all over, is when they used to, I live in a beach community, and they sent people out to the beach, and they would give voters application to vote, to register to vote, and then they'd collect them, and all the ones who registered Democratic, they'd throw away.
Jeez.
Now, that would be to register to vote. That's different than what's going on now, and I understand what you're saying
now.
Well,
what's going on now against the law, Connie?
Well, see, you don't really know what's going on yet because
you
haven't been able to look at one. But if they want you to send your application back to the Republican Party or the committee, that is legal for them to do.
But I do have one here in my hand, Connie, and what it's for a voter in my city of Madison, Wisconsin. But then they have the return address for the absentee ballot request card going to the city clerk in Mayville, Wisconsin.
Well, that is, I have never ever heard of that before.
Yeah.
And you've got to call that city clerk in Mayville, and you've just got to get that done and get it from the horse's mouth, because the best thing people can do is ask their own registrar voters for an absentee ballot. And see, a registrar has to get, that's why they want your written signature, is because when the election official gets your request for an absentee ballot, he or she has to check your signature on your request with the signature on your one on file there. Then when they see that it's you, they send you the ballot.
I appreciate
then when you vote the ballot. Yeah, you've just got to go to the registrar of voters, you've got to go to that city clerk, and you've got to pin it down what it's about.
And then you should probably go to the media, too, because they might want a story that is different than the chew toy that has become the lipstick on a pig bull. You know what I'm saying. Thanks for the call, Connie. Where do we go from here? Let's go to Justin in Michigan. Justin, you're on Air America Radio.
Hi there. Yeah. Sorry it was just bad news, but I used to live in Pittsfield Township here in Michigan, and I recently moved to Milan Township. Not only did it have my address, my new address that it came to, wasn't forwarded, but the return address on it was for my county clerk's office in Pittsfield Township.
That is the same thing we are hearing over and over again this morning. This is what's freaking me out. I got to tell you, Justin, this is a way.
I'm not even a registered Democrat. The only thing I can think of is I've donated to Barack Obama, and I know for a fact that if you go on like Huffington Post, I can see who donated what to who.
And that's how they found who you were, and that's why they sent you the misleading absentee ballot. Listen, this is the story, and we need to take it to the media until they decide it is important enough to cover our democracy, or the subversion of which is taking place at the hands of John McCain, Karl Rove, and the cronies in his campaign. All right, tag, you're it. My name's Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman today. Thank you for having me. I'll be back tomorrow right here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.